Please welcome Michael Kaplan.
I wish that this were a story about me in the fast lane, but the truth is, it's a story about me thinking I was in the fast lane, and that any minute the bumper-to-bumper traffic was going to clear up, and I would start going at a velocity I had never experienced before. And it wouldn't surprise you to know that this happened in Los Angeles, which is really, I think, the mecca of unrequited fast lanes. And I was trying to carve out a career as a screenwriter with my friend John. And we had bumped along for a few years. And then we sold an idea to a producer. It was a comedy suspense about a romantic disaster of a young man who gets jury duty and becomes infatuated with the woman who's on trial, and against his better judgment and the law, follows her outside of the courtroom and realizes that there's a conspiracy attached to the crime that she's on trial for, and that he needs to solve this mystery and kind of save her life without getting caught and thrown in jail. And so we wrote it, and the old-time producer hated it. But then another producer picked it up and brought it to a studio, and they liked it, and then they didn't like it. And, you know, it looked like it was just going to sink into the La Brea tar pit of benign neglect. And then we heard that there was a director who wanted to make it. And he was actually a fairly famous director. His name is Peter Bogdanovich. And you may recognize that name. Maybe you've seen his movies, or maybe you remember that he was in town a few months ago for the SLO International Film Festival, getting the King Vidor Lifetime Award. I was really excited because he made some films that I thought were amazing, like Last Picture Show and What's Up Doc and Paper Moon. But I was also a little wary because about 6 years earlier, he had been wrapped up in an awful Hollywood tragedy. He had cast a former Playboy centerfold named Dorothy Stratton in one of his movies, and they had fallen in love and made plans to live together and make movies together, and then her husband shot her to death. And after that, he'd made one movie, and nobody really knew if he had had a major breakdown, how traumatized he was. But we were invited to his house to meet him, and he told us that he loved the script and that he thought it was a wonderful blend of comedy and suspense, and the characters were great and crackling dialogue. And I was no psychiatrist, but clearly this man was fine. More importantly, he was our ticket to the fast lane. You know, we were going to do this, he was going to make our movie, and then the opportunities would come rolling in. And I was just over the moon about this. And it took about a month for all the deals to fall into place, and then we were summoned back to his house once again. And he came bouncing into the room, and he told us, you know, a lot of people say that a screenplay is a blueprint for a movie. I don't even think it's a blueprint. And the demolition derby started. He told us that he decided this would really work wonderfully as a great, crazy, madcap screwball comedy. And John and I looked at each other in a panic. You know, I mean, what about the suspense? What about the balance? What about the crackling dialogue? But he was convinced that he had the right angle. And there's this trope with screwball comedies where you take the most handsome leading man in Hollywood, and you put glasses on him, and you have him bumble and stumble around. And this was Cary Grant in Bringing Up Baby, and Bogdanovich did this with Ryan O'Neal in What's Up Doc, and he told us that he had cast Rob Lowe to be in our movie, and he was going to put glasses on him and have him stumble and bumble around, and we were just in shock. It was all wrong. And he started to pull our script apart and then jam it back together with whatever made him laugh. and he made himself laugh constantly. You know, every time we would meet at his house, he would come into the room with some new idea that he just had, obviously, in the car or on the toilet. And then he would burst into this slow, erupting laughter that was supposed to seal the deal. I mean, how could you say no in the face of the great man's mirth? But we said no a lot. We just didn't like the ideas, and we kept trying to defend what we had on the page. But these weren't arguments that we were going to win. I mean, really, the only recourse that we had with no power was to nod our head and then not put it in the script and hope that he'd forget. And that did happen a lot. And during these meetings, he would frequently be, you know, condescending and bullying. But the thing that really aggravated me was that he loved to do imitations. But not of people you'd ever heard speak before. You know, it wasn't like he was doing Jimmy Stewart or Alfred Hitchcock. He'd say, you know, Howard Hawks once said, a good picture has three good scenes and no bad scenes. I don't know if that's a good Howard Hawks. You know, I've never heard the guy talk before. I thought the whole point with imitations is it's like a bonding experience. You know, you've both heard the person and you kind of nod and say, yeah, that really sounds like him. But, you know, he was all about imitating George Cukor and Fred Zinnemann and famous directors just to reinforce the fact that he'd rubbed elbows with them and, you know, we never had. And so we should shut up and learn from him. My revenge was that I developed a Peter Bogdanovich imitation. This is Peter Bogdanovich after he's told us the latest idea that he had on the toilet. So we went on like this, back and forth, and then he tells us he wants to put a brand new character in the film. He wants this one female character to have a sidekick, a young woman with a thick Canadian accent. And he explains, she'll say, I've been out in a boat. And he'll go, you've been out in a boat? No, I've been out in a boat. Oh, you've been out and about. And this was a disaster. And we tried to explain it was going to bloat the scenes. It was going to break the suspense. It wasn't going to work at all. I tried every tact I could to talk him out of it until the producer, who was this very proper British man who had lost all power to Bogdanovich in this situation, took me aside and said, don't you understand? He's writing this for Louise. Well, Louise was the younger sister of the murdered Playboy centerfold. And they had come together in their grief, and then they had gotten involved, and he had moved her into his house, and he had paid for plastic surgery to make her look a little more like her sister. And now he was casting her in a film as well. And under the guise of a frothy madcap comedy, we were acting out this dark gothic psychodrama. And every morning as I sat there in his living room, the shadows seemed to be coming further in, and I'd notice how dingy the place was becoming and certain parts of the house were in disrepair. We had to get out of the situation. And so John and I, we begged off. We said that we had another project to do, which was true. It wasn't very high profile, but it was a lot more lighthearted. And Bogdanovich was furious. And we didn't see him again until he held a screening for the cast and crew. And he got up to introduce the movie, and he blamed everybody and said that there had been a lot of ego on the production. And he did some imitations. You know, he did probably King Vidor. And then he screened this lopsided, incoherent piece of shit. And the dizzier and crazier it tried to be, it was like the slower it went. And John and I sat there just painfully aware of every joke and every punchline that he had ripped out, because we couldn't help but be painfully aware he'd left all the straight lines and all the setup lines, and I could never understand why. It was like he perversely wanted these moments to die on the vine, or he was encouraging the actors to go off book and just do their own thing. It was mind-numbing. And this was my movie, Illegally Yours. It's the only movie that we ever got made. And you won't find our name on it because we took the money and hid. We used pseudonyms. And, you know, it should have gone straight to video, but it actually played for 1 week in a theater in Daly City, up in the Bay Area, which meant that the critic from the Chronicle reviewed it. And I don't know if you're familiar with reviews in the San Francisco Chronicle. They don't use, you know, five-star system or the four tickets. They use the little man in the chair. If you get a great review, the little man is standing on the chair applauding. And if it's pretty good, sitting in the chair applauding. And if it's average, he's just watching in the chair. And if it's really bad, he's asleep in the chair. And then there's what we got, which was just a chair. I really did think that I was in the fast lane, and it turned out that I was stranded on the side of the highway with smoke billowing out from under the hood of the car, two flat tires, no jack, just my bare hands, and the driver sitting behind the wheel going, "Forget about the horsepower, next time I'll bring a horse." Thanks for listening.